From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, formerly secret documents that reveal the secret history of American policy. We talk with Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive. It uses the Freedom of Information Act to declassify government documents. We'll go through some of the archive's greatest hits, including secret documents about our relationship with Saddam Hussein, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and on the lighter side, Nixon's meeting with Elvis Presley, and a failed plan to use cats as spies. The archive is currently working to declassify documents pertaining to the National Security Agency's wiretapping of American citizens. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews reissues by saxophonists Ike Quebec, Booker Irvin, and Leo Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tom Blanton has become an expert in finding out government secrets, secrets that he thinks will help keep government honest without sacrificing our security. We're talking about documents pertaining to the war on terrorism, the strategy for dealing with Saddam Hussein, how we started bombing North Vietnam, Iran-Contra, Henry Kissinger, Latin American death squads, not to mention the meeting between President Nixon and Elvis Presley. Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive, a research institute and library that collects and publishes declassified documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. It's located at George Washington University. The archive is celebrating its 20th anniversary. We invited Blanton to talk about some of the most significant documents they've gotten declassified. I asked him first if the archive has played a role in the recent revelation that President Bush authorized the National Security Agency to wiretap without warrants the international phone calls of American citizens speaking with suspected terrorists.
So far, the role we've played is just public and reporters getting our initials confused. They're the big NSA. They have a huge multi-billion dollar budget. We're the little NSA. Actually, we avoid even using the initials. We call ourselves the archive because they're the folks who can wiretap your cell phone, who can pick up packets of digital information off internet nodes, who devour hundreds of millions of intercepts every year. And we're the folks who file a couple thousand Freedom of Information requests each year and try to get at the policy decisions that are shrouded by secrecy. I think that's the heart of this wiretapping story, because there are real secrets, technical secrets, about how the government can go into an internet node or a fiber optic cable or a router and bring back together all those little packets of digital information, ones and zeros, and put them together and give them to translators and code breakers and make sense out of them. And those are some real secrets. Those are capabilities that if they were exposed, we might lose them. But the secret that isn't a real secret, that doesn't damage our security, is the existence of this program, period. And the secrecy that shrouded this thing for the last 3 years was clearly to prevent a public debate about what's the right balance, what's the right amount of power we should let the president have in a time of war, what's the role of Congress, the public, the courts, and that's what the White House prevented, and it's breaking loose now.
But the president has argued that revealing the existence of this secret wiretap program tips off people linked with terrorists and tips off the terrorists themselves about what we're doing, that we might be tapping their phones, and that makes it harder for us to be able to get information from them through wiretaps.
It's no secret that our government's trying to wiretap people's phones. Everybody in the mafia for the last 50 years has known that the government's trying to wiretap their phones, and terrorists around the world have, you know, buy cell phones at public phone cards at little markets in order to avoid being tracked, and drug smugglers use payphones and rolls of quarters. I mean, this is it's what you might call a public secret. What really the White House prevented was people questioning what they're up to.
Did the National Security Archive do any work in helping to declassify the documents that revealed the National Security Agency wiretap program?
There's almost nothing that has been declassified yet. We've got requests in, but there's only literally, I think, two actual documents that have been released. One is a letter from Senator Rockefeller to Vice President Cheney saying, you know, I can't even evaluate this program, much less endorse it because of all the secrecy around it. And then the minority leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, just released her letter, a similar letter to the head of the National Security Agency saying, what's going on here? You guys are expanding the targets of your wiretapping, but you're not really giving us a good basis for that or good explanation. What's going on? Well, those queries, those concerns by members of Congress have been classified for 3-4 years. It's kept both Congress, the courts, and the public from having this debate about, is this right? Does this fit with American values? Is this what we want to be doing in the war on terrorism, or is this going too far?
Now, you mentioned that there are some secrets, for instance, with the secret wiretapping program, that could really undermine our efforts to catch terrorists, and that would include,
right,
you mentioned, the programs that we use to tap and interpret phone calls. Where do you draw the line? How do you determine what documents you're going to go after and try to declassify, and what you think is really none of our business, what you think needs to actually be kept secret from the public for the sake of our own safety?
I think there's a pretty common sense line you can draw about what's a real secret and what's a fake secret. And the real secrets are ones that you and I and just about any other person with common sense would recognize: the design of a chemical warhead or a nuclear weapon, the identity of some intelligence asset who'd be shot or whose family would be tortured if it was known they were passing secrets, or, you know, the bottom line of our government in some diplomatic or trade negotiation. Those are real secrets, but too many of the secrets are the fake secrets. And I just give you one example. Republican Governor Tom Kaine of formerly New Jersey, who headed the 9/11 Commission, was looking at the government's most top secret terrorism and counterterrorism information in that investigation. What really happened on 9/11? Really recent stuff, I mean current stuff. He said that 75% of what he saw that was classified shouldn't have been classified. And there are lots of other officials who've given similar kind of estimates, ranging from 50 to 90%. I mean, last year, Congressman Chris Shays really pushed one of Don Rumsfeld's deputies and said, come on, come on. We all know there's too much classification going on. Give me a number. How much is it? And she kind of grudgingly admitted, well, kind of 50-50. Well, if you know 50% of what's classified shouldn't be, then you got to ask the question, is it keeping us safe, those fake secrets? And that was the number one finding of the 9/11 Commission, that it was the secrecy that did us damage. It was the failure to share information. It was having a memo from an FBI agent out in Phoenix saying there's Islamic militants in flight school, and it's classified and it goes into a classified vault in Washington and nobody ever sends it on to even the other FBI agents in Minnesota who had arrested one of those guys.
My guest is Tom Blanton. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive, which works to declassify secret documents when they're relevant to public policy debates. The group helps journalists, historians, and scholars use the Freedom of Information Act. On your website, you posted a report from the National Security Agency called Transition 2001, which relates to this story now about the National Security Agency tapping phone calls with American citizens suspected of talking with terrorists. What's this report and what's its relevance to the story today?
It's a fascinating document because the National Security Agency, just as the Bush administration is coming into office back in 2000 after the Supreme Court ruled in Bush v. Gore, and they're coming in and the National Security Agency says to them in this transition briefer, and it was originally written as an unclassified document because so many of the Bush people hadn't gotten their clearances yet. And so the National Security Agency wanted them to know, look, here's the problem we're facing. The problem, they said in that document, was that to have a presence on the living network, the web, the internet, inevitably the packets of digital data we're going to be wiretapping, intercepting, picking up, they're going to have not just the targeted communications of terrorists and adversaries, but also the supposedly protected communications of American citizens, the ones where you have to get a warrant to be able to read or to listen to. And what the National Security Agency was saying, let's have a national discussion about how far we should go and whether our authorities are up to date and what we should do about this problem, because the internet, it's an internet distributed information world. All this stuff is mixed together. It's not discrete phone calls like we used to get from the mafia. What's fascinating to me about the wiretapping story is the Bush administration didn't choose to have that debate, and they didn't choose to go back to Congress and say, let's update these authorities, and they didn't choose to respond to the National Security Agency invitation. Instead, they chose to do a unilateral, preemptive presidential power expansion. And I think that may be at the heart of many of these secrecy issues and policy issues, whether it's the torture memos or the rollbacks of Freedom of Information or presidential records or Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force or this current wiretap controversy. It's at every juncture the White House has chosen to let's expand, let's get more presidential power.
My guest is Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive. We'll talk about a secret memo to Donald Rumsfeld about Saddam Hussein after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive, and the archive is celebrating its 20th anniversary. Before we talk about some of the other documents over the years that the National Security Archive has gotten released, formerly declassified documents, talk with us a little bit about why the archive was created in the first place 20 years ago.
There's a founding myth to the National Security Archive that goes back to the middle of the 1980s, and a bunch of journalists and scholars and independent researchers had been getting documents released through the Freedom of Information Act, and I think at a certain point, 1984, 85, their spouses rebelled and said, get the paper out of our house. Get it off our kitchen table. Either the boxes go or I go. And they invented the National Security Archive, I think, originally to save their marriages. And they did. We've been a family values institution ever since. And we still get donations of boxes from people's basements. But the reality is we inherited not just all those boxes of paper, but we inherited still pending Freedom of Information requests, because the system really doesn't disgorge the secrets unless you push it, unless you ask, unless you follow up, unless you nudge, unless you threaten a lawsuit. And that is the real role of our little institution, a kind of counter-institution, pushing the system to cough up the policy documents, not the technical, not the secrets, not the weapon systems, but the choices that we make.
How have the hurdles changed over the years that you have to get through in order to have documents declassified?
Mainly, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, the system has just slowed down dramatically. So back in 2001, it took about 18 months, say, to get a document released from President Reagan or the first Bush term. Now the delay is about 5 years before you can even get the government to look at that document for declassification. So it's the Bush White House has basically thrown sand in the gears of what was already kind of rusty, but a system that a lot of people wanted to use. 4 million Freedom of Information requests last year. People, biggest user group are actually veterans and their families looking for their service records and benefits. And second largest group is senior citizens looking for retirement and Medicare and Social Security information. Third largest group is government contractors and regulated companies. Actually, journalists and groups like ours are a tiny fraction. I mean, literally less than 5%, and certain most agencies less than 1%.
And what do the rules of the Freedom of Information Act say? How do they define what documents could be declassified upon request?
They basically say if you, as a requester, can actually identify the document reasonably so that a person on the inside could find it, then it's covered by the law. And unless the government can find one of about 9 specific reasons to withhold it, and there's a lot of lawsuits over the years that have defined exactly what that means. The first reason is obviously national security, but the government has to be able to identify what harm would occur. There's other exemptions that are like personal privacy or protect a current law enforcement investigation. But the bottom line is the law says there's a presumption of openness in our government, and unless the government can identify a specific reason where some real harm would be done, and the good from release wouldn't outweigh it, then the document has to come out. So the two keys are, one, identify the document that you want as best you can. Ideally, you have a date, an office, even an author. So we use all the other documents we get. We scan them to look for references to stuff we should be asking for. We read the newspaper every day to look for documents that we should be asking for. We read former officials' memoirs. It's a constant kind of excavation, if you will, of this enormous national security apparatus that's largely shrouded by secrecy.
You have assembled what you consider to be the National Security Archive's greatest hits, so to speak.
It was a hard call, I have to say. Out of literally, we've liberated millions of pages of documents. I mean, we saved 40 million White House email, for example, from one of our lawsuits. But the greatest hits, some of them were ones that just were obvious, like the front page story when we got released the flag-draped casket photos from Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon, in an order originally signed by Dick Cheney, had said no media coverage of these homecoming ceremonies. For 50 years, the television cameras and the press would cover these solemn, extraordinarily respectful moments when the flag-draped coffins would come off the airplane at Dover Air Base in Delaware and come home, and they would be honored, respected. The duty of the honor guard was the highest calling of a soldier.
What did you have to do to challenge this policy and make it legal for video footage or photographs of these coffins of soldiers? Yeah, go ahead.
It's still not legal for the press to go in. The courts have actually held there's no First Amendment right of access to military bases, and you can see that, you know, that argument was crafted as a classic case. I think the media overreached to say we have a right to go to the airport runway. Well, you don't have a right to go onto a missile base or an Air Force base. But our argument was much more simple. It said the Freedom of Information Act says if you can't identify the harm, then you got to release the documents. And the coffins weren't identified by the person unless the Pentagon had already released their names, so there was no privacy issue. There was no national security issue. There was a discomfort at the White House that flag-draped coffins coming home, being on the nightly news, might affect public opinion about the war. But here was a ceremony that had been public for 50 years, through World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, shut down by the people in this administration. What we got were the photographs they take internally, mostly for their own training purposes, to show the next honor guard how to do it right. So we believe that those are government records. Those should be public. That's the way we should honor the fallen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive, which works to declassify secret documents that might shed light on American policy and American history. As we said, you've compiled a list of your greatest hits, so to speak, and that includes some briefing notes for Donald Rumsfeld's visit to Baghdad in March of 1984. What is this briefing memo? What does it have to say?
In the whole debate about Iraq and the Iraq War, one of the pieces that's been missing is this knowledge of what our U.S. government's relationship with Saddam Hussein has been over the years. And what's largely forgotten, particularly when Don Rumsfeld gets up at the podium and talks about pounding the Iraqi army, is that Don Rumsfeld went and shook hands with Saddam Hussein in 1983 and helped turn Saddam into our ally, because back in the 1980s, it was useful to have Iraq as a counterbalance to Iran, the mullahs, the ayatollahs, the hostage takers, who were seen as the big danger. So to look at the Saddam Hussein issue in Iraq as an issue in our foreign policy, we believe you need these primary sources, you need the context, you need some sense of the history. And that particular document are the briefing notes that say to Don Rumsfeld, special envoy from President Reagan, we want to be your friend, Saddam. We see you as an ally. And sure enough, he became our ally, and we gave him intelligence, and we helped him beat up on the Iranians. And so it's more than ironic. It helps, I think, citizens understand the real basis on which policymakers make decisions.
Now, this briefing memo for Donald Rumsfeld, who was a special envoy to Iraq at the time, in it he was urged to tell Iraq Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz that the U.S. statement on chemical weapons was made, quote, strictly out of strong opposition to the use of lethal and incapacitating chemical weapons wherever it occurs. And from what I've read on your website, this visit was supposed to help do damage control because the U.S. had made a strong statement against chemical weapons, but we wanted to make sure that we didn't completely alienate Saddam Hussein, who we wanted as an ally.
That's right. And that is the enormous tragedy, which is weapons of mass destruction and Saddam's possession of them became the reason given by the administration to go to war in Iraq. And yet, back when Saddam really had weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, in the 1980s, and really used them against Iran, we denounced use of chemical weapons publicly, but then sent secret envoy named Don Rumsfeld to Saddam to say, hey, don't pay attention to that. It's really, we still want you as our ally. And later on in the 1980s, gave Saddam intelligence that he used to drop more chemical weapons on the Iranians and even his own people. So the tragedy, one of the many tragedies of Iraq, is that when Saddam actually had weapons of mass destruction, we were on his side. And when he no longer had them, we invaded. And it makes a really uneasy, I think, juxtaposition for people like Don Rumsfeld, who were part of the earlier policy and are part of it today.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From WorkSong, Rhino, and Starbucks, presenting I Believe to My Soul, a CD featuring five soul artists. Information at starbucks.com/hearmusic. And from Universal Pictures and DreamWorks Pictures, presenting Munich, a new film directed by Steven Spielberg, in theaters everywhere, January 6th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's Ike Quebec. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews reissues by Quebec and two other saxophonists, Booker Irvin and Leo Parker. And Tom Blanton tells us about Nixon's meeting with Elvis Presley and a failed plan to use cats as spies. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive, an organization that works to declassify secret government documents that will shed light on American policy and history. They work with journalists and scholars. The archive is celebrating its 20th anniversary. One of the documents that the National Security Archive recently helped declassify pertains to the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which led to the bombing of North Vietnam. What does this why don't you describe first what the Gulf of Tonkin incident was?
Back in summer of 1964, the U.S. was running some covert operations, not known publicly, to sort of pushed the North Vietnamese along the shore of the Gulf of Tonkin. And the North Vietnamese attacked a U.S. destroyer on August 2nd, 1964, got whacked pretty badly by the destroyer, a bunch of their folks wounded, a ship mostly sunk, and retreated to lick their wounds. But 2 days later, there was supposedly a second attack. At least the President Johnson and the National Security Agency reported it as a second attack, and that became the rationale for Johnson ordering the first major bombing strikes on North Vietnam, the first major escalation of the war in Vietnam, and a congressional resolution, Gulf of Tonkin resolution, that was used for years thereafter to authorize the wider war in Vietnam. So the parallels with Iraq are resonant, to say the least. And now we know, because of a long-suppressed secret set of intercepts, that the second attack was a fake, that some of the National Security Agency officials even knew it at the time. But they helped the administration by creating the intelligence the White House wanted to see.
Robert Henyuk, who is a historian with the National Security Agency, wrote a report about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and challenged whether it ever happened. He wrote that 90% of the intercepts of North Vietnamese communications relevant to the supposed Tonkin attack were omitted from the major agency documents going to policymakers. The overwhelming body of reports, if used, would have told the story that no attack had happened.
Henyuk deserves a ton of credit because, as a professional historian inside, he's trying to get the National Security Agency and the government as a whole to learn the lessons, to understand its own history. The sad part of the story is that it took 40 years for him to get the National Security Agency to learn that lesson. And that is one of the huge costs of secrecy, which is the government itself doesn't know what it's done. The government itself can't fix its mistakes. The government itself can't do it right the next time because it doesn't know that it was wrong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton, the executive director of the National Security Archive, which works to declassify secret documents that might shed light on public policy. Now, there's a kind of lighter side to the National Security Archive, and some of those documents are on your greatest hits list. And one of those pertains to the secret meeting between Elvis Presley and President Nixon. And on your website, you actually put up the handwritten letter that Elvis sent President Nixon asking for a meeting. The handwriting's a little hard to read. So sum up for us what this letter has to say.
Well, we found out back, oh, this is 10 years ago now, that the immortal photograph of President Nixon shaking hands with Elvis Presley, you've seen it everywhere. It's been on book covers,
I have it on
coffee
mugs,
on T-shirts, exactly. We found out at the National Archives of our country that this was the single most requested document in the entire files, the entire archives, more than copies of the Constitution or the Gettysburg Address or the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights, that it's Nixon and Elvis. That's what people really wanted to take home when they visited the National Archives. And so as documents fetishists, we know that if the president ever meets with somebody in the White House, there's a whole paper trail. There'll be a briefing memo and probably some talking points for him to make, and there'll be some probably other pictures on the roll from the White House photographer. So one of our brilliant staff people just files a Freedom of Information request, said we want all the documents and any media related in whole or in part to this meeting between Nixon and Elvis, and she attaches a copy of the photograph with the date. And what comes back is this file. The first item is a handwritten letter from Elvis on American Airlines stationery saying that, "Dear President Nixon, I was also one of the most outstanding young men, and I'd really like to be an honorary federal agent at large to help fight the drug war." In other words, Elvis is asking to be a narc, to get an honorary badge as a narc. Great irony given what we know about how he died of barbiturate overdoses later on. But he says, "I've been made an honorary deputy sheriff by Shelby County, Tennessee, and Memphis, and by other folks, and I really would like to help." And he says how to reach him, and he's under an assumed name at the Hotel Washington, and he gives his bodyguards names and all this. It's a fascinating little letter. The next item is a little memo from the appointment secretary to the White House chief of staff. And the appointment secretary says, as you know, Elvis showed up at the front gate of the White House this morning asking to see the president. This is not how it's done, I have to say. You know, you have to line up for an appointment with the president, you know, months in advance. But Elvis shows up, sends in this letter, and this young appointment secretary, Dwight Chapin, later of Watergate fame, says to the White House chief of staff, I think, you know, the president ought to meet with some bright young people, and Elvis would be a good place to start. Well, out to the side of that recommendation, the White House chief of staff writes, you must be kidding. But he goes ahead and approves the meeting. Next item is a set of talking points for the president. Maybe, Elvis, you could do a TV special, get high on life, don't use drugs, help us fight the drug war. Next item in there is, you know, a little report on the meeting by one of the White House staff who attended. Then there's a little note from a secretary saying, oh, Elvis left all these autographed photographs. You can go ahead and take them home. And what are we going to do with the ceremonial pistol that he brought in for the president?
Why were these documents classified?
The system default setting is on secret. In other words, if you don't ask for documents to be released, the government will just sit on them more or less indefinitely. I mean, the system started to be reformed in the 1990s, and President Clinton actually did a couple of executive orders trying to get the old secrets out of the system because it costs real money to keep a secret. It costs about $460 every time to the taxpayers per year every time somebody stamps a new record secret. Part of our role is to try to push out the secrets that don't need to be secrets, the secrets that we ought to be debating, the secrets that really shouldn't be taking up space in the secret files. Because if you keep everything secret, then you're discrediting your whole system.
In the National Security Archive's greatest hits list, there's also something called Project Acoustic Kitty. You got documents released that describe what this secret weapon was supposed to be. Why don't you describe it?
Well, you can see why the CIA might have wanted to keep this project secret all these years, because some of those brilliant rocket scientists out there thought about surgically implanting microphones and transmitters into cats to use them as walking bugs. They'd given up on dogs. They get too easily distracted. There were very few other critters that would actually go and curl up and sit in a single place like a park bench, for example, if you're trying to surveil some Soviet diplomat. And so they went to all the trouble of testing all these animals, settled on cats, went to all the trouble of figuring out how to implant the mics. The code name was Acoustic Kitty, and they wired their first trained cat for sound and released it as a field test near a park with a target that it was going to go to. Unfortunately, got run over by a taxi. They called off the whole operation, and the declassified document 40 years later showed that, well, the environmental factors were probably working against us. We probably shouldn't try these cat surveillance again.
My guest is Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive. We'll talk about the unintended consequences of his work after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive, which works to declassify secret government documents using the Freedom of Information Act. You've worked to declassify so many secret documents over the years. Have you ever been surprised in a negative way by the repercussions of having documents publicly released? Have you ever thought, well, maybe this shouldn't have been made public? Maybe it was secret for a good reason. Has it ever backfired in any way on the country or on the lives of individuals?
I can only think of a couple examples in my own experience where, looking at the document, I would say, they shouldn't have released this. But mostly those have been not a national security but a personal privacy matter. For example, when we got the White House email released and I did a book of the email, some of the email messages that were released I read as sexual harassment, actually, and I thought the government didn't have any business releasing them to me. But that is quite rare because really after looking at millions of pages, and you can see for yourself, we publish all this stuff, look at it and judge for yourself. Are there real secrets in there? And so rarely is there a real secret. Mostly it's stuff that just from inertia stayed secret. Sometimes it's stuff that's secret because it hides embarrassment, like a failed project, like Acoustic Kitty. Most of the time, those secrets, the policy secrets, are because one bureaucrat or another, or one president or another, was just trying to control the debate, prevent debate, frame the debate. That's what drives 50% of the secrecy, 75% of the secrecy, depends on who you ask.
You mentioned your book on White House email. Where does email fit in when you're applying for the release of secret documents?
Nowadays, email is how the government really does its business. And I'll just give you a little data point. Our lawsuit that saved the White House email when President Reagan's national security advisor, a guy named Colin Powell, decided to delete it all back in 1989, ultimately saved about 100, 150,000 email from the Reagan years, about 200, 250,000 email from the first Bush term, and 30 million email from Clinton's 8 years. You see that exponential growth of the electronic messaging is a fascinating dynamic because it's all electronic, which means it's going to be easier to save and easier to search. It's also sometimes easier to destroy, except as we found out with White House email, maybe not, because once you send out an email, it exists in multiple forms and multiple places and backup tapes and other people's user areas. If you're writing email, I guess one of the lessons of the information age is expect it ultimately to be public. Historians of tomorrow are going to have a lot more to work with, but it will be on computers, and so it may well be easier to work with.
You have read so many classified documents over the years, classified documents that became declassified. I'm wondering if you could single out one or two of the best and worst writers of memos that you've come across over the years.
Well, I tell you, the former official that in certain ways I'm most grateful to, although he certainly would reject my gratitude, is Henry Kissinger, who out of either ego or with his memoirs in view, required that every word he uttered during his 8 years as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State be recorded. His aides would be at meetings with him till 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and then they'd have to stay up to 3 or 4 in the morning to write up the verbatim memoranda conversation. When he got on the phone, his secretaries listened in and made transcripts. So you have these wonderful moments where, you know, President Nixon calls up his national security advisor, and Nixon's tape machine is rolling, and Kissinger doesn't know about it. But Kissinger's secretaries are listening in, and Nixon doesn't know about it. They're mutually wiretapping each other. The net effect, though, is this phenomenal verbatim record of decisions at the highest levels of U.S. foreign policy. And I think Kissinger never thought these documents would come out in his lifetime. They directly contradict a lot of what he wrote in his memoirs. They show all kinds of bad behavior on his part, telling Pinochet, for example, just like Rumsfeld told Saddam Hussein, listen, we're going to say publicly you're a bad guy, but don't take it personally. You know, we're really on your side.
Do you worry that your attempts to declassify documents will ultimately have the unintended consequence of having people in power document less of their conversations to prevent just this kind of declassification?
Because absolutely.
Yeah.
There is a real price, which is, you know, after Watergate, we don't have the verbatim audio tapes that Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon kept. We don't have a minute-by-minute verbatim account of what they said in the Oval Office. And that is a real loss to history. But there's a again, a check and balance in this system. The knowledge that your conversations might become public has a clarifying effect on behavior. It prevents, I think, the worst of those behaviors. The secrecy really cost our democracy during Vietnam and Watergate, and I think this secrecy today will see the costs. We are already seeing them in Iraq, and we'll see them indefinitely in the future. There is a cost, and at the same time, there's that wonderful phenomenon, if you've ever been at a kindergartner's birthday party, like my daughters have had, where they do that game where one of them whispers into the person's sitting next to them ear, and then that person whispers to the next, and it goes all the way around the room, and by the time the message comes back, it's completely garbled. You can't run a government on winks and nods and oral instructions. You have to record things. You have to write things down. You have to have orders. You have to have task leaders. And with the electronic media, they're creating vastly more records today than we had, say, on the Spanish-American War or even on World War II or the Vietnam War. And so ultimately, I think the price of not having presidents tape their conversations for fear of it ultimately being released is one that we've chosen to pay because we want to keep presidents from running black bag jobs or lying about their secret bombing of a foreign country.
I think there were some words from the satirical newspaper The Onion that you wanted to leave us with.
Back in November, The Onion ran a wonderful story, I think, that really captured the heart of the matter. And the headline was, CIA realizes it's been using black highlighters all these years. And it says, Dateline Langley, Virginia, report released Tuesday by the CIA's Office of the Inspector General revealed the CIA has mistakenly obscured hundreds of thousands of pages of critical intelligence with black highlighters. According to the report, sections of the documents, quote, almost invariably the most crucial passages, are marred by an indelible black ink that renders the lines impossible to read. It really gets at the absurdity and how so much of this secrecy just prevents other parts of the government from knowing what's really been going on.
Well, Tom Blanton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tom Blanton is the director of the National Security Archive, which is located at George Washington University's Gilman Library. Before we get to our review of three new jazz reissues, I want to tell you about tomorrow's show. We're going to feature the interview and performance we recorded in 2000 with Dion. We talked about the doo-wop records he's best known for, but he also played songs that showed his blues and country influences. Now he has a new CD of blues and country songs. Here's a track from it.
You got me running, got me hiding, got me run, hide, hide, run anywhere you wanna let it roll. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got me doing what you want me, baby, what you. I'm going up, going down, going up, down, down, up, anywhere you wanna let it roll. Yeah, yeah. Got me doing what you want me.
We'll hear from Dion on tomorrow's show. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews reissues by saxophonists Ike Quebec, Booker Irvin, and Leo Parker. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says one sign of jazz's riches is how many great musicians often get overlooked, crowded out by other stupendous players. So today he takes a quick look at three favorite second-tier saxophonists with recent reissues: Booker Ervin, Leo Parker, and this one, Ike Quebec.
Quebec, 1959, on Sweet and Lovely, showing off a few of his winning traits. Striking shifts between loud and soft notes, achingly slow bends, and lines that drift like smoke rings. He's a first-rate storyteller, which in jazz means his solos have a distinctive voice and a sense of drama and direction. The complete Blue Note 45 sessions of Ike Quebec on two CDs have been out before, but not lately, and the return of these organ group sides cut for the jukebox trade is a reason to be happy. Quebec mixes Ben Webster's drowsy whispers and Dexter Gordon's swagger in his own blender. He sounds great up-tempo, but he's best on ballads, especially tender ones like What Is There to Say? Our second tenor storyteller is the Texas saxophonist Booker Ervin, who mixed old and new vocabularies in an original way. His crying long tones echo 19th century field hollers, but he offset those with fast and agitated phrases. That balancing act recalls 60s tenor supreme John Coltrane, but Ervin's pliant tone and Southwest accent gave him his own voice. Here's Ervin on a 1968 session now out as Textbook Tenor. That's Billy Higgins on drums. Booker Ervin recorded that for Blue Note only after making his masterworks for Prestige, the Freedom Book, the Space Book, and the Blues and Ballad books, but this is a worthy follow-up. Leo Parker also came to Blue Note long after making his name as bebop's gold medal baritone saxophonist. One size larger than tenor, the magnificently burly baritone itself is too often neglected. Leo Parker had played alto before switching to the bighorn, so he was used to playing fast. His 1961 album, Let Me Tell You About It, aimed to be his comeback after years off the scene. Parker and his sextet were ready. Thank you. Cleo Parker's comeback never got rolling. A heart attack killed him 4 months later. The Ike Quebec and Booker Irvin we just heard came from late in their careers, too. Quebec died in 63, a year after cutting his last singles, and Irvin in 1970, 2 years after his session. None of them lived to be 45. Cold comfort to them, but at least their music's in circulation 40 years later. That's what some jazz musicians get instead of long lives. They get reissued.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the complete Blue Note 45 sessions by Ike Quebec, Textbook Tenor by Booker Irvin, and Let Me Tell You About It by Leo Parker. All are on the Blue Note label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. From Bantam Books, publisher of The Sacred Cut, a modern mystery set in Rome by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org.